Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/bookshow. Then go over to morbidlybeautiful.com as we are now part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcasting Network. Hello, welcome back to the All-American Spook Show Podcast. I'm Josh, and I'm joined here with Tiana.
Hey.
And the Professor Smook.
What's up?
Donnie is on assignment. He couldn't be with us. And I'm going to talk about this just for a minute here off the start. Will probably won't be joining us as much anymore. He's not quitting the Spook Show, but we wanted to put it out there officially for all the longtime listeners that you're probably going to hear him far less moving forward. He said he'd still poke his head in from time to time, and he'll always be a member of the Spook Show. I mean, once a member, always a member, I think is kind of the way we all look at it. But he's just got a lot going on in life, and he probably just won't, you know. And if you've noticed, and all over the last year or so, he hasn't been on as much. So we're just kind of really making it official, really moving forward, that, you know, you won't hear him as much. So obviously, we wish he could be here every week, you know, with the rest of us, but, you know, life. But like I said, hopefully you'll hear his voice from time to time, and I'm sure he'll give us 2 cents if it calls for it. And he'll still make a selection. You know how, you know, longtime listeners will know that we kind of do a rotation of, we select the movies and we all take a turn doing that. So like he'll still have his turn in the rotation. Hopefully at least on those episodes, he can still pop up. But if not, you know, if you don't hear his voice, you go, hey, whatever happened to that guy? Then, well, this is our explainer to say that, you know, just stuff's getting in the way and he's just not able to do this as often as he used to. So that's that. But Donnie had some stuff going on this week, so he's not here. But moving on to what you came here to listen to, honestly, is the latest Cannon Fodder. Now, if you're new to the show and you don't know what Cannon Fodder is, essentially, we randomly will spin and select a movie from the Golden Globus Canon Films productions of the 80s, almost literally of the entirely just the 80s, right? Smug is like basically like they took over 1980 and then pretty much stopped by 89 or 90, right? So it's like their prime years are almost that entire decade, right?
Yeah, they might have had a couple of into the early 90s, maybe a little bit of here or there, but not anything that they're as well known for as the 80s stuff.
Yeah, because,
and then of course we didn't cover the stuff prior to like the super early Canon things that they were, you know, they weren't really in America yet, I think, or something, or whatever.
Well, yeah, Canon Films itself, the production company, actually goes back to the 60s, but yeah, Golden and Globus weren't involved in it until like the late 70s or so, and they actually did produce some stuff for the old, I think it was Dewey Friedland Canon, you know, those were the guys that owned it back then. They produced some stuff for them, and then eventually just bought the company. And that's the prime Canon Films that we all know and love right there is when they took over. So that's really what the focus of Canon Fodder is that decade, those years where, you know, they were kings of the kind of the low budget 80s action sci-fi type stuff that they made throughout the 80s. So that's the focus of this. And like I said, it's random wheel spin that we arrive on these things because we've literally got every single title that we haven't talked about up to date on that wheel, and we spin it, and whatever it lands on, that's what we do. And then, ironically, it just so happened to land on Missing in Action 2, The Beginning, after our last Cannon Fodder was Missing in Action 3. Totally. Yeah. I mean, like, we need to buy some lottery tickets, right? Like, what the hell are the odds of this happening, to be honest with you? With like,
we wiped out most of the Missing in Action films already. Well, we have.
Yeah, this is it. Yeah, because, like, we did the first Missing in Action all the way back, and I think it was episode 122. If I'm not mistaken. So it's been a minute, but
a little bit, but
yeah, we've already done it. And then we swing back around and we spin it. It lands on 3. Like, well, at some point we'll get to 2, and damn, if it wasn't the next time around that we're getting to 2. So, and of course we're watching them out of order the way they probably intended in some ways too, right?
Well, they made them out of order, you could say, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah, exactly. But
well, they didn't make them out of order, but yeah, they played them out of order.
But like you said, we'll get into it. But before we get into all that, and there's lots to talk about here, we'll go ahead and toss out the usual information, and that's we want you to visit to aaspookshow.com. We call that the center of the Spook Show universe From there, you can listen to our past podcast archives. All the episodes are there. Also, you have access to our YouTube channel from there, where every month we have Video Vortex, Grindhouse Gutter, Hammer Horn Order, and of course, all the podcast episodes go up there. So every week, there's lots going on over on our YouTube channel. And from aaspookshow.com, you can also access our Patreon. We want you to become a patron at patreon.com/aaspookshow. And when you become a patron, you get every month, at certain levels, of course, we have many different levels there, but at certain levels, you get every month video minisodes, including the Library of the Professor, and you also get Craps for Peace Theater. Every month, we put up a poll of, we'll throw up four or five nominees of like the shittiest movies we can think of, and we put those out on our socials, and you, the listeners and viewers, vote as often as you want. We tabulate those at the end of the month or at the first of the month, and then, you know, that's what we're going to do that particular month. And the only place to listen to that is patreon.com/aaspookshow. So with all that out of the way, we'll go ahead and toss to the trailer for Missing in Action 2, The Beginning.
Vietnam, 1984. Chuck Norris frees the Americans. Missing in Action. Now, the secret of his rage can be revealed. Missing in Action 2, The Beginning. A war he couldn't forget.
You're going down! Get ready to jump!
The story behind his return. Vietnam, 1972. Captured in a savage jungle war.
You men are not prisoners of war. You are common criminals.
Imprisoned and tortured.
He's not dead! God, help!
Chuck Norris is a prisoner they couldn't break. And a soldier they couldn't hold.
Look, our country has forgotten about us, and we have to do anything we can to survive.
There's one chance for escape.
That's our way out.
He's breaking out and fighting back. An American hero. His story continues.
This is for me.
Chuck Norris, Missing in Action 2, The Beginning.
All right, so before we get into the background and really our history with it and all that jazz, we'll go ahead and toss to the latest from a recurring guest here on the show, Austin Trunick, who is the author of The Canon Film Guides, Volume 1 and 2, which you can find on Amazon and various other websites. And we highly encourage you to go pick up a copy of that book, because if you're a fan of Canon films at all, which if you're listening to this, you probably are, you need these books. These are perfect companion pieces and explain in depth all the behind the scenes information on almost literally every single Golden and Globus produced Canon film. So you don't want to miss those out. But every time we have a Canon Fodder episode, we do his segment's called Canon Chronicles. So here it is.
Canon Chronicles with Austin Trunick.
Hello, Spook Show audience. Austin Trunick here, author of the Canon Film Guide books. I'm here to talk about Missing in Action 2, The Beginning from 1985. So Chuck Norris, by the early 1980s, was really trying hard to branch out within his movie career. He'd been starring in his own movies since the late 70s, but they were mostly films about him kicking people around. You might consider them urban kung fu movies. Chuck had been a dominant karate champion back in the 60s and early 70s and was incredibly famous within the martial arts community. But in terms of movies, he was pretty much just written off as Chuck Norris karate guy. There were people who loved kung fu, of course, but mainstream audiences still kind of regarded the genre as stuff you'd see at the cheap seat theaters or on badly dubbed late night television airings. Chuck really wanted to get away from what he was calling, in his words, that chop socky image. You start to see that in his early films of the 1980s. His characters, well, they started carrying guns. The problem was he'd sign up to do those sort of movies, and then the directors would find an excuse to disarm his character or rewrite the scene so that he'd be punching or kicking instead of blasting or bombing or blowing up people. He'd sign up to play a cop, but wind up playing a karate cop by the time everything was all said and done. So that's when he started developing his own projects. One thing he really wanted to do was a Vietnam movie. That was it was a personal thing for him. He lost a younger brother in Vietnam, and this would be his sort of tribute to his deceased brother. So he worked with writer James Bruner on a script called Missing in Action. He wound up shopping the script around Hollywood and landing a meeting with Cannon Films. Cannon wanted to make Missing in Action, but it turns out it wasn't the Missing in Action that that Chuck thought they were bringing him in to meet about. It was a different script they had that had the same name, just different script, also called Missing in Action. Chuck decided to do the movie anyway. That movie wound up being Missing in Action 2, The Beginning, through a very convoluted path. But essentially, Cannon decided that as they were finishing up that film, they liked it so much, they liked working with Chuck Norris, that they'd go ahead and shoot a sequel back to back. So they took the first script that Chuck had written with Bruner and brought to them and had James Bruner basically rewrite it, rename the character after James Braddock, and make it so that it was a sequel to, or at least it would fit in a series with Missing in Action 2, The Beginning. They took that film to the distributor that was going to handle their movie, Missing in Action 2 being the film, and they rejected it. Basically, Cannon had a deal in place with them. They had the first look. They could watch a movie and decide whether they wanted it or not. And they did not like Missing in Action 2 at the beginning, which was at that point just Missing in Action. Cannon had gone so far as to print posters and marketing materials with the title Missing in Action for this particular movie. So at that time, they were finishing up the what they thought was going to be the sequel. They watched it, and Cannon realized that it was a better movie. It was especially a better one to launch an action hero with. It is a movie where Chuck Norris heads off to Vietnam many years after the war is over to save the POWs, and very much in the vein of a big 80s action film, whereas Missing in Action 2, Chuck Norris spends a great deal of the runtime of the movie being tortured. And that's maybe not the best way to introduce a new potential action hero franchise to audiences. So they decided to pull a little flipsy-daisy on the movies. They released Missing in Action, the second movie, as the first movie, Missing in Action. And the first movie they filmed, very confusingly, became the sequel that was also a prequel, became Missing in Action 2, The Beginning. And the first Missing in Action was a hit. It was the number one movie at the box office when it premiered, and it became the most successful movie that Cannon ever made. They already had a sequel in line. It came out less than 5 months later in theaters, and that was Missing in Action 2, The Beginning. So, yeah, that's the very roundabout way that this movie got that very weird title. It was filmed first, meant to be the first movie, and just flipped around. As far as it goes, it is, of the three Missing in Action movies, Missing in Action 2, The Beginning is my third ranking. I would put it at the bottom of my rankings of those films. The first Missing in Action being my favorite. I think it's great. It's probably my second or third favorite of the Chuck Norris canon movies. With Invasion USA being the obvious number one and the number two. You'd have to catch me on that day and ask me. It would change between a couple of them. But, yeah, I do think it's kind of slow to get going. That's my biggest thing. It spends a lot of time with him just, yeah, being tortured and biting rats and things like that. So, yeah, as far as a rating, I'm not a person who's ever loved giving ratings, so this is hard for me. And it's especially hard because with the Cannon movies, I've talked to so many people and I've interviewed people. I'm friends with a lot of these people on Facebook and through other things, through my books. So it's hard. I've become attached. And yeah, it's like, I feel like I'm being asked to assign ratings to my family members, I guess, at this point. But anyways, I'm going to try here, and I'm just going to go by the rankings. Missing in Action 1 would be a five for me. Missing in Action 3, Braddock, would be number 2, and I have to give that a 4. And so Missing in Action 2, The Beginning, gets a 3 out of 5 for me, just by virtue of being my least favorite of the Missing in Action movies. And with that, Spook Show, listeners, I am out. Again, this is Austin Trunick, Canon Film Guide author, and I will talk to you next time.
All right, there you go. That's all. We appreciate Austin coming on every time we do a Canon Fodder. You literally can't go to anyone else probably on the planet other than somebody that's still alive that worked at Canon back in the 80s that has as much information as Austin Trunick does about everything Canon. So we appreciate him every episode of Canon Fodder giving us his Canon Chronicles segment. So, Smoke, I guess I'll throw to you first. What's your history with old Missing in Action 2, The Beginning?
I did see it in the theater when I saw the first one in the theater, and I saw this one in the theater. I did not see Missing in Action 3 or Braddock Missing in Action 3. I missed that one when it came out.
You would think like age wise, it would have been the other way around. Like, I saw maybe 2, yeah, probably 3, and not the first one. But no, you saw the first 2.
Yeah, I saw the first 2. Well, there was not to go too far off of, divert too far off the subject, but it is kind of on the subject a little bit. Is the reason why I saw the first one in the theater and the second one really is because at that time, I think both of them were rated R, right?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Is because in my hometown, I don't know how it was everywhere else, but they weren't so strict on checking IDs at those times. Now, they did get a little bit stricter by the time, because of slasher movies. We talked about this before. Slasher movies of the late 80s and early 90s, there was a big thing with parents and other activist groups like pushing against the violence in slasher movies and all that stuff. And so whenever that was going on, PMRC for music and all that stuff, Satanic Panic and all this stuff was in the air at the time. So they were trying to crack down on things like putting parental stickers on on CDs or whatever, right? And so the music stores wouldn't sell those to me. And then they started cracking down on the R-rated movies. So then they did start IDing people. And then so it didn't happen. But I remember seeing the first, with maybe some friends or whatever going, I didn't go with my parents to see Missing in Action, but they would drop us off at the theaters and go see whatever, at that time. So I did get to see those two. And I was definitely only 11 or 12 years old whenever the first one came out, and 12, 13, whatever, when the second one came out, I think. Definitely saw those two in the theater. And I remember at that age, 12 to 13, I do remember one scene the one scene that sticks out the most that kind of messed me up a little bit as a kid watching this was when, we'll get to it in the plot or whatever, but I mean, it's not like it's giving too much away right now, is when the Vietnamese guy kills the chicken, the pet that the guy had, and throws it back out in the pit. Yeah, they kind of wiped me out as a kid. I'm like, God, what a sick bastard who kills that. They always see this guy in that in Vietnam over there. He kills and throws it back down somewhere. I remember that upsetting me as a kid. Watching more than any of the human violence going on.
And you're just like, get him, Chuck Norris.
Yeah, kill that bastard. Kill this chicken. No, he choked. I think he choked his chicken.
Well, okay. Tiana, I know you, since you loved Missing in Action 3 so much, I'm sure you have a deep, deep rooted history with Missing in Action 2 here, right?
I mean, of course, I grew up with it because of my dad watching Chuck Norris. This is definitely the one that I've seen the least amount of.
Do you think this is kind of a guy versus girl kind of thing here, where it's like you're probably not going to find a whole hell of a lot of women that probably love the 80s action flicks of Chuck Norris?
I don't know. I mean, I do.
Probably in general. I would say in general.
Yeah, you're in generality.
Your dad.
Yeah.
But yeah, general probably is. That's probably true in general.
Yeah. Yeah, because this is the kind of stuff that Smoke and I would have loved. I'll speak for Smoke because I know I did. This was made for us in the 80s, growing up. So
yeah. My sister would, because me and my cousin, who's 1 year older than I am, but we all grew up together. This type of movie or the Rambo movies, we're running around in the woods by our house making little traps and digging these little holes or whatever and covering up with leaves and make my sister chase us and run across it and get tripped up in the hole.
Thanks to this kind of shit in Rambo, you're right. Like, as kids, we were running around playing Vietnam. I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
It's fucked up. Let's set some...
in a survival knife. Remember the survival knife?
Oh, yeah. It was cool. Dude, yeah.
I had the survival knife with a compass and the little, hand. It was cheap as shit,
Yeah, of course.
We didn't know any better then. We made and terrible or whatever, unless you got a really good one, but we did. Camouflage, cast iron, not cast iron, but that aluminum handle, that would, if you hit it, it would break.
And it's because of movies like this too, like, because it seems like we've had this, you know, small conversation about this before. We're like, if you think back on our childhoods in the 80s, it's kind of messed up, like, how they marketed this shit to us. You know, like, they made toys and stuff of Rambo and Chuck Norris and all this stuff. Like, it's kind of messed up looking back on it. Like, you know, maybe that wasn't the smartest thing. I don't know. they're straight up marketing R-rated movies to, like, six-year-olds.
Yep. And then, you know, you get the little play sets with the fake hand grenades.
Yeah.
Just a little plastic hand
grenade. Yeah. Well, I mean, we all had it of a certain age, you know, in the 80s and into the early 90s. I mean, we all had these toys. So it is, and
all our guns look real. The fake guns look real, but then they didn't worry about painting them orange or blue or something to make them look like not real, you know, because, well, you know, we weren't like holding up gas stations.
No. Well, unfortunately, all it takes is a couple of dumbasses to ruin it for everybody else, right?
Yeah. Then you got these multicolored rainbow gun things or whatever that, you know, those don't look cool. You know?
Yeah. Until somebody gets a real one painted like a rainbow and then we're all screwed.
That's right. Yeah.
My history is the same. Now, I'm almost positive, and I may have mentioned this when we did, you know, part one or part three. I'm almost positive that my parents took me to the movie theater, like, you know, not for me to see this movie, but, like, I guess they wanted to see this movie. And, like, well, we don't have a babysitter, so you're coming along. Because I vaguely remember some of these scenes, like, but I was in a movie theater. Either that or I'm just dreaming or imagining the whole thing. But I'm almost, because I would have been, let's see, this came out in 85. Hold on, I got it in my notes, like the exact date it came out. It came out, it was released March 1st of 85. So, like, I was 4 years old, almost five, when this thing was released. So, like, my memory is patchy and vague, right? But I'm almost positive I went into a movie theater to see this movie. Because for some reason, I remember, like, Chuck Norris, Vietnam, and, like, the POWs being in, like, the bamboo cages and stuff. You know, like, I remember that vividly from, but just, you know, in patches. So I'm almost positive of it.
Y'all had the family night with Missing in Action, too?
Yeah. And that's the messed up thing, too, and we'll get into it in a second. Like, the numbers-wise, like, this probably didn't play very long. So the odds of me going to the theater and seeing this when I'm, like, you know, 4 years old are slim to none, but I'm pretty sure of it. Which I think is a good time to go ahead and start getting into background information. I actually found an alternate title to this, which I found was kind of interesting. Apparently in Australia, New Zealand, and in the United Kingdom, this movie was known as Battle Rage. And that was the theatrical release name, apparently. So
now, I wonder if it had anything to do with, like, MIA not being a UK thing. Like, yeah, I mean, when their military personnel go missing, if they call it something else, like, a Missing in Action wouldn't really hold the same, you know.
Yeah, maybe.
Same connotation, or I don't know.
Maybe they were trying to set it apart from the first one, because I'm not sure what, I don't remember there being alternate titles for Missing in Action, the first one in 84, when we talked about that. Maybe there were. So maybe they were trying to set it apart from that movie over there by calling it Battle Rage. I don't know the reasons. I didn't see specific reasons, but yeah, Battle Rage has a completely different tone to it than the actual title.
Maybe they didn't want to have a sequel. Maybe they didn't over there make as much money on their such and such part two.
Yeah.
You know,
overall, they were probably right, but we'll get into that. It was released March 1st, 1985. Of course, produced by Cannon Films and distributed by MGM. It was rated R, total runtime of 1 hour and 40 minutes. On IMDb, it's listed as action, drama, thriller. It was filmed in Jalapa, Veracruz, Mexico, and in the island of St. Kitts and Nevis in around June to July of 1984 for a budget of $2.4 million, which kind of sounds a little high for a Cannon flick, $2.4 million. But it went on to a worldwide gross of $10.7 million, which, you know, isn't probably I wouldn't probably necessarily say that's a failure, but it's actually, you know, it's not really a winning success either, you know, considering. You would think at the time this would have done a lot better. And especially,
I don't know if you have it right with you, if you had the stats on the first one, like what it made at the box office.
The first movie made $22.8 million worldwide. The second movie, which we're talking about here, made $10.7 million worldwide. And then the third movie, Law of Diminishing Returns, made $6.1 million worldwide. So clearly the balloon was off the rose by the time the third one came around. But I think they made the right decision as far as if you're comparing one and two, and they were supposed to be the opposite order. But if you're comparing the two movies as movies, they probably made the right decision to release them in the order they did, in my opinion.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, and if you're trying to go, you know, right off the top, more bang for the buck, so to speak. Yeah, you know, they would, because you could have flopped. They could have done the other way around. The first one could have got out there. It could have got bad press. You know, as bad a press as, I mean, I'm sure Cannon had a lot of bad press for their movies, but they still went on and did well.
Yeah.
But this one probably would probably a little bit, you know, it's kind of, if you compare it to that one, it is a little bit more lackluster than the other movie, you know, so I'm sure it would have not made as much as being the first movie. Then when the sequel came out, they probably wouldn't care as much about seeing part two if the first one wasn't as good and didn't do that well. So yeah, they probably gambled and did it right, you know, as far as them being a money-making, you know, machine, as far as Cannon, you know, putting these movies out there for next to nothing and making massive money off of them and compared to what it cost to make.
Well, and, you know, once again, we have the benefit of hindsight. When we go back and look at the top 10 in the box office that particular weekend, so we're looking at the weekend of March 1st through the 3rd, 1985, and boy, it was going up against some pretty stiff competition, I'd say, at least a few of these. Number 10, The Falcon and the Snowman. Number 9, 1984. It was in its 12th week. Number 8, A Passage to India. Number 7, Vision Quest in its 3rd week. Number 6, The Killing Fields. Number 5, in its opening weekend, The Sure Thing. Number 4, in its 3rd week, The Breakfast Club. It is, but like it wasn't necessarily raking in the dough, but that obviously went on to be one of the bigger movies of the 80s, right? The Breakfast Club. Yeah. In its debut at number 3, Missing in Action 2, The Beginning, it made $3.8 million that weekend to come in at number 3. Number 2, Witness. And number 1, which was just killing it at the box office still, in its 13th week, Beverly Hills Cop. It made $5.1 million to win the box office that weekend, and it had already raked in just under $175 million at that time. So, yeah, Beverly Hills Cop, Axel Foley, he was kicking some ass.
There was some stiff competition in there. There's some that I forgot of those movies. I don't even remember Falcon and the Snowman. I remember by name, but I don't remember what it was.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's always like that too. When you, I don't remember this one, or you know, this one. Well, I haven't thought of that in 25 years. But yeah, there's always a lot of that. But it's always cool to look back when we have that, you know, that old history available to us.
Yeah,
and it was directed by Lance Hull, who really only directed, I think, like 3 other titles, and really the main one is Steel Dawn. He directed that.
Mm-hmm. Patrick Swayze, post-apocalypse movie, which is fun in its own right. Yeah.
I'd be shocked if it doesn't land here on Cult Corner or something in some form on the show or on YouTube at some point, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And like you said, I was looking at that too. His other ones were like two. One of them was in 2020. It didn't look all that interesting to me.
Yeah, I did notice that. It's like he kind of went away for a while, and then all of a sudden he'd made some stuff in the last few years. Like, okay, all right, Lance Hull's back.
99 was something, and then 2020.
Yeah, it's like, okay.
Movies like, they were something. I don't know, I didn't really look too deep into the other two.
It was written by the same team of guys that wrote the other two films, so they wrote or had a hand in all three of these Missing in Action flicks. Steve Bing, who also worked on one of Tiana's favorite movies, Kangaroo Jack.
Oh, yeah.
Larry Levinson, who has produced like lots and lots of TV movies, television series. I mean, it's too many to list. There's tons. Literally hundreds, I think.
And with Barry Levinson.
Yeah. You can see where that might be a confusion. And Arthur Silver, who also was one of the creators, or maybe the creator, but at least one of the co-creators, of that Married with Children knockoff that came out in the 90s called Unhappily Ever After. Do you remember that one?
I never even saw that one, I don't think, or at least I don't remember it.
It was like almost straight up like, and he actually worked on Married with Children a handful of episodes there too, but it was almost a straight up like WB, Paramount Network type of Married with Children ripoff that was in the mid to late 90s, Unhappily Ever After. But he did like 100 and something episodes of that. It stars, of course, Chuck Norris as Colonel Braddock. I mean, like, we've talked about him a number of times already now with the other two films and Invasion USA, I think we've done here on Cannon Fodder. I think that's the only Chucks we've done so far. Just 4, I think. But 4 of many that will come, I'm sure. There's a lot more to come. But, yeah, you know who Chuck Norris is. I mean, like, honestly, it's blasphemy to say you don't know who Chuck Norris is, right? He might come and kick your head off if you say you don't let Chuck Norris in.
He'll just appear in your living room if you say it.
Yeah, yeah.
Chuck Norris.
What?
And then all of a sudden you turn around and you're there. It also stars Soon Tech Oh as Colonel Yin. Now, you may remember him from, I mean, he's been in tons of stuff. A character actor who was in a lot of stuff in the 80s and 90s. You may remember he was the sensei in Beverly Hills Ninja.
Yeah. I know that I didn't go into his filmography.
Mm-hmm.
But I did. Yeah, I know.
Lots of other stuff. That one and that one. Trust me. But he was also one of the voices in Mulan, you know, the 90s Disney animated Mulan. He was one of the voices in that one as well. Unfortunately, he passed away back in 2018. It also stars Stephen Williams as Nestor. People listening to this might recognize him from Jason Goes to Hell. He was also in, had a small role in 2017's It and a number of other flicks. I mean, once again, a dude that's been around and you see his face, you know, trust me, you recognize Stephen Williams. So, yeah, I mean, really, that's probably your main stars here. I mean, like, there's some other ones like Cozy Costa plays Mazzilli, Joe Michael Terry is Opelka, John Wesley is Franklin. These are the guys that are like the POWs in the camp. And, of course, Christopher Carey is Emerson, you know, the guy that kind of pretends he's I don't know exactly what the hell he was pretending he was. He was pretending he was like a part of a team that was going to rescue the POWs or something. And then they...
Yeah, well... Even the reason why he was there to begin with, he was just there on his own, curiosity. I think that's where POW camps around here.
He just randomly decides to just go wandering the jungles of Vietnam to see if there's any camps around, I guess. It's his own.
And in his own words, when he was talking to the POWs down there, after he did this little spiel of, like, saying he was this person and he's got this team and they're coming in and all he's got to do, he's got a homing device and he's got all this stuff. He gives the word, the signal, there he's going to come in there and clean up if you don't, you know, agree to let these POWs go or whatever. So he gives them a spiel, then he goes down there and with the POWs, with Chuck Norris, the guys, and he's telling them, I don't know, I'm just here by myself. I don't know. Nobody even knows I'm here.
Yeah.
It's like, what? Why would you go into the Vietnamese jungle when no one even knows you're there, first of all?
Yeah.
Willing, you know, you're not a POW, you're willingly in there. But yeah, yeah, whatever the case for that guy.
And of course.
He was a stalker, yeah, with a... At first, well, he thought he was, anyways. He didn't really get very far with him, I guess. Guy probably didn't believe him anyways.
And, of course, one of the more memorable side character and character actors that's in this is Professor Toru Tanaka. You know, just the big guy that's one of the guards in the camp. Yeah, like, he was a wrestler. Dude was in a ton of these type of movies. He was in Last Action Hero, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, The Running Man, Dark Man. I mean, tons and tons of stuff throughout the 80s and 90s. Unfortunately, he passed away back in 2000, but yeah, he was a guy that you would definitely recognize when you see him, and he was in a ton of these type of movies. Background-wise, that's pretty much about all I had. I mean, did you have anything else you wanted to point out before we get into it?
Well, it's not really background necessarily, but it's some stuff that happened, like at the beginning, when Chuck Norris jumps out of the helicopter, he's got all the people that are in the helicopter, the pilot gets shot. And I don't know why. I guess Chuck Norris thought he was going to fly the helicopter because he's Chuck Norris. And then he gets rid of flying it or whatever, and then it's going down.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody jumps out in slow sort of motion, and then it goes, boom, missing in action, like stamp on the screen every time one of the people jumped out of the chopper and hit the water. And then Chuck Norris was the last one out of the chopper. There was a scene of smoke because the helicopter was hit with, like, bullets or whatever. You could see the fog smoke machine on the ground or whatever. You know, shooting the smoke up, it was supposed to be like from the helicopter, you know, smoking or whatever when it got shot.
Mm-hmm.
The job was just a little flub, I guess, or whatever. You know, this could have happened with Canon because they're shooting things for, you know, in this case, $2 million, which was big budget, I guess, for Canon, but smaller budget for movies at that time. And now you can't even pay your main actor with that budget.
Yeah.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The management of this drive-in theater is happy to announce you can enjoy your favorite form of movie entertainment regardless of rain. No longer will it be necessary to let rain spoil your fun. Now you can keep your windshield clear and dry with a drizzle guard. Simply attach it to your windshield, and in a jiffy, you're enjoying the movie without constantly running your windshield wipers.
For you listeners of the All-American Spook Show podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out the service. So I hopped on over to audible.com, and I just typed in action movies to see what would pop up. And honestly, it's like a bunch of, for some reason, it's a bunch of Minecraft. It's a bunch of Minecraft books. But the one at the very top is the one that interested me the most. And there's like 700 results, so I'm sure there's some other cool stuff in there. This one's called The Last Action Heroes, The Triumphs, Flops, and Feuds of Hollywood's Kings of Carnage by Nick DeSimlin. And that one is right at 10 hours long. So that, and the cover is cool. It's like, you know, one of those 80s throwback poster type covers, like drawn or painted covers with like Schwarzenegger. Yeah, it was like Schwarzenegger and Stallone and Dolph Lundgren and all the rest. Chuck Norris is probably in there. Yeah, there he is from Invasion USA. He's on there. So this sounds like a pretty cool listen or read there. So, and of course, like 1,000 Minecraft books pop up for some reason. But if any of that floats your boat, you can head on over to audibletrial.com/spookshow. Again, that's audibletrial.com/spookshow for your free audio books. And now I'm going to hop on back over to imdb.com and click on plot summaries to see if they've got any kind of deep synopsis of this movie on here. And boy, they do not. All we've got is one, and that's pretty much just the brief one. But this pretty much tells us what we need to know. Prequel to the first Missing in Action, set in the early 1980s, it shows the capture of Colonel Braddock during the Vietnam War in the 1970s and his captivity with other American POWs in a brutal prison camp and his plans to escape. I mean, that pretty much explains, you know, what's going on here. And honestly, this movie, it's like, I mean, it's, you know, it kind of is what it is and it's well done, but like, man, it is really long for this type of movie, is it not?
Yeah. Because, also though, you know, well, you can see also why maybe swap the movies around, because Chuck Norris, if you really look at the amount of action in the beginning versus what happens near the end, they almost had to make a longer movie because, and I can almost see it now. I mean, I'm just making this up because I don't know. I haven't read it, but like, if they made it an hour and a half, and you know, and you show this and you screen it, people are like, well, Chuck Norris doesn't do any action. Chuck Norris isn't Chuck Norris in this movie until about this point, which is like probably halfway through a normal hour and a half movie.
Yeah, I'd say it's probably, you're probably a good 50 minutes or so in.
Yeah, because of the way he's written. He's written as being this tough guy who's like not going to break down.
Yeah.
You know, he's not going to be broken down by the torture and the camp and all that stuff. So he's playing the stoic role, you know, and so not acting on anything, not, you know, not getting worked up or not beating anybody up and all this until the scene where he fights the, I can't remember the guy's name, but the black guy who would like, swap sides. Nesky was getting, you know, he wasn't putting the down in the pit. He was like helping out the Vietnamese side or whatever.
Yeah, Nestor.
You know? Nestor, yeah. So when they were fighting, you know, that's the first time you see any action from Chuck Norris, really.
Yeah.
And that's a good point to the end of the movie. And then when they finally break out of the POW camp, stuff starts happening. It's almost like they had to, like, shoot, all right, we need to extend this because he hasn't really done any fighting or anything for the first however long it's been. So that's almost like what I imagine in my mind happened. Like, okay, we need to extend this movie and make it longer because he's not doing anything until halfway point.
Yeah, you're probably not wrong. Like, they probably got in there, especially after the first one, right? Because, like, really, I think they had kind of shot these out of order. Like, I think they had made this first and then the second one. And then they're like, wait a minute, that second one's a better movie. Let's flop them. So now, right, they're probably sitting there, you know, 6 months to a year later, like, fuck, we need to juice this thing up a little bit, you know, when compared to the first one. So then they start putting in more action.
And you can't really take out, I mean, if that was the case, you can't really take out the story because the story's pretty primary. I mean, if they would have done that, they pared out all they could have pared out to keep the tension going between the torture and things that were happening to the POWs versus how they make you feel, you know, characterization and all this stuff they're building. However it happened, I guess the movie had to be as long as it was if you wanted to have action-packed climax and have Chuck doing his thing and still have characterization of the, you know, making you care about these people and all that stuff.
Yeah, they really do a pretty fair job in this movie of wanting you to get to that point where like he's got to get revenge on Colonel Yen, right? Like there has to be that final showdown between these two guys. Cause that's essentially what this movie is about, is like Colonel Yen is the guy in charge of this prison camp that's holding them hostage and they're torturing everybody and him in particular to get him to, admit war crimes, right? Like, That's what this is about. And like, and he's just like, nope, I'm not going to do it. You know, I'm not going to do it. And then eventually, you know, they break him to the point where he does it. And then, you know, of course they, renege on the deal, so to speak, but they really do a good job of building up to that. Like, man, you know, he's really got to stick it to this dude. And for a brief moment there at the end, I almost thought like, yeah, it was pretty good, but there could have been more. And then bam. Okay, there we go. That's Chuck Norris.
Yeah.
You know, that's,
yeah,
that's the 80s canon touch.
Yeah. And then it keeps going. Like he keeps, you know, from this scene to that scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, beat the shit out of it. And even the flamethrower scene. Oh, and there's that scene too. They do a good job of making you, and that, there's a little bit of background on that one. I could have said at the beginning, but I'll say it now. But whenever the guy gets torched on the bridge when he's trying to escape the POW camp,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's running across the rope bridge or whatever. Then on the other side is a Vietnamese guy with a flamethrower. He's just,
yeah, he just comes out of nowhere.
It comes out of nowhere, like just blasts him with a flamethrower, and the guy falls, you know, into the waterfall. Which, hey, thankfully it put the water out. I mean, the fire out. Unfortunately, it fell only 500 feet or whatever was down to the rocks and waterfall below anyway.
Yeah.
And, of course, he died. But that scene, I heard Chuck Norris, and apparently this was in, this is another book. I'm not sure if this was on that Audible, but I should have asked you to check for it, too. But there's a book, Against All Odds, that Chuck Norris wrote a biography kind of of.
Seems like we did, we've talked about that one on the Audible read, you know, in other Chuck Norris episodes.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, that one, and that book. Look, he talks about that scene with the flamethrower where, because Chuck Norris's brother was in Vietnam, he died in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I guess in order to evoke the emotion, he only wanted to shoot that scene once. He said he was going to, you know, I guess, you know, get his mindset to where what happened to his brother in Vietnam when the guy, you know, set the dude on fire on the road bridge. And so that emotion, I guess, he had on his face when that, after that, after the fact when that happened is him thinking of his brother dying in Vietnam. So he said he only wanted to do that take once because he didn't want to have to think about that more than, you know, for one scene.
Yeah, that reminds me. A little bit later on, there's another scene because there's various scenes of torture in this movie, right? And one of them is where they tie Chuck Norris upside down and hang him upside down.
Yeah.
And then they piss off a rat.
Yeah, it's poking it with a...
Yeah, they pissed off a rat and then put it in a burlap sack and then put it on his head. And... apparently, Chuck Norris claims that they didn't have a fake rat. So, he told them to kill a rat, and that scene, he puts a real dead rat in his mouth, and then just wiggles around, you know, like the rat is, you know, scratching him up, fucking him up, or whatever. And then when they pull the thing out, like that brief thing that you see is a real dead rat hanging out of his mouth, and then they put fake blood on his face and all that, you know, to make it look like that. And then he said the whole time all he was thinking of was, oh my God, I'm going to catch the bubonic plague.
Yeah, I thought that rat looked pretty realistic for a canon film's special effects.
I don't know if there's any confirmation of that, but that's what, and who were you to doubt Chuck Norris, right? But that's what he claims, is that that's a real rat hanging out of his mouth, a real dead rat.
Yeah, it did look like it now that you mentioned.
Yeah. How about the at the very beginning, that font? Am I the only one that font that they use for the opening credits reminds them of Gilligan's Island? I don't know why.
You're talking about the actual, not the missing in action stamp things, but you're talking about the font of the...
Yeah. Yeah. Like the yellow font that's like, you know, produced by, directed by, so starring. It looks like Gilligan's, like an episode of Gilligan's Island is coming on. And then I noticed in those credits, it says music by Brian May. And I'm like, oh, what the fuck? The guitarist from Queen? What?
Yeah.
And well, then I look it up. No, it's not. It's not him. It's a different Brian May.
It is the Brian May though that did the soundtrack for Mad Max and The Road Warrior.
Yeah. Now,
if you're acutely listening, or if you've seen those movies more than a handful of times, you'll notice some music cues from those two movies because he reused some of those sounds.
Yeah. When I looked it up, there was a number of credits from Brian May that like I'm like, oh, okay, he's done this. That, you know, there were a lot of memorable credits, but at first I'm like, what? The guitarist from Queen is the... I'm like, this doesn't sound anything like Highlander. And then I'm like, oh, wait, no, never mind. How about the different types of torture? We've got, these are the ones that I listed off, okay? We've got the fake execution, right? Like, that's pretty fucked up. Like we're going to kill this dude, and then they just click, you know, it does. And then they do it like two or three times, right? So there's the, and then they just push him down, like, get out of here, you know? So there's the fake execution.
It kind of reminds me, like, they saw the scene, you know, they take these Vietnam movies and, like, remember that scene in Deer Hunter with the Russian roulette? Let's do that, except it's not really Russian roulette. It's just them fucking with them, torturing them. But they do it like it's a Russian roulette because they pull the trigger, like you said, three times. And each time the guy thinks it's going to be that time that he gets his boy breath.
Yeah, they're clearly just doing it to fuck with him, like to the point where he's about to piss his pants. Because like then they're just like, yeah, go throw him back in the cell, you know. And he's just, you know, as you would. But it's fucked up.
Also, they also did that, I think, to tease the scene where they do that later in the movie with somebody. Only they don't remember that it was the guy that we were talking about earlier. It was Australian guy who was there, you know, taking photos of the camp and who tried to bullshit his way into. Letting the POW, you know, making the POWs go.
Yeah,
if you have a team come.
Emerson.
That guy, Emerson. Yeah. They do the same thing to him, and then somebody, one of the POWs in the cell, you know, the bamboo cage cell thing says, it's just a trick, you know, and then as soon as he says that, they pull the trigger, and then boom, it's a bullet.
They're just like, yeah, they're not going to do it. They're just messing with you. And he's like, then he says something like, oh, they got a hell of a sense of humor, and then pow.
Yeah, then
blow his brain
out. So I feel like they used the other part to set that up, of course, too. You know,
I know we don't do the gore score here, but that probably would have bumped it up a nudge, right?
Yeah, that was. Yeah, this movie did have a little bit of that, as far as because it's, you know, they're going into the whole Vietnamese torture stuff, so it did have a little bit of you know, not straight out and out splatter or anything, but it did have some gory bits.
How about some more tortures? They kill the pet chicken. Remember, Mazzilli has like the pet chicken. Then he didn't for no reason. He's just like, "You're gonna spend your last night here," or whatever he says, and then just snaps the chicken's neck and throws it down in there. You know, oh no,
yeah. That's like I said off the top of the show. That's the one that kind of because I saw this in the theater. That was only it was 85 that it came out, right?
Yeah, 85.
So I was like, well, what or 11, depending. I forget what you said. What month it came out? Oh, it came out in March.
March 85.
83, 84. So I was 11.
Yeah,
when I saw this.
That's at that age where, like, you still care enough about, like, seeing this, you know, type of shit where you're like, oh, no, not the chicken.
Yeah, that time in 1985, I had not yet seen Make Them Die Slowly or Cannibal Holocaust yet.
So I wasn't
the jaded teenager yet.
Yeah.
Jaded horse.
You were the jaded person you would become very soon. But so the chicken death still affects you at this point. And how about the worst torture of them all, the blue ball scene?
I was about to say the helicopter delivery.
So they a helicopter. Oh, okay. By the way, I didn't think I'd check off opium dealing helicopter full of hookers off of the 2024 bingo card. But here we are. But how about the only way I can describe it is the blue ball scene? They've got. You know, hookers there, three or four of them. They drag like a couple of them out. They bring one of the dudes out, and then they're just like, you know, rubbing all over him, caressing it, and then they start undressing him. They pull him almost completely nude. He is nude, but like, you know, all you see is his bare ass.
Yeah, his ass is facing the camera.
And he's facing away from the camera, and then they just turn around and laugh and walk away. So that's the only way I can describe it as the blue ball scene. Like, man, they left that dude totally hanging and then just walked away and laughed. That's fucked up. The worst type of... you can only imagine. It's got to be the worst torture for, like, dudes that have been in a fucking prison camp for a decade, right? Or the better part of a decade here. Good Lord. They never really discussed the exact time frame here, right? Because I think from what I remember, you see 1972 Vietnam at the beginning. And then you just know there's some passage of time, but they don't ever say a date again.
I do remember, though, and I think it was one of the, maybe it was the Reagan newscast that they show the footage of, which they use real footage of in this movie to talking about POWs and everything.
Early 80s.
I thought there was a mention of 10 years somewhere. I mean, I don't think it came up on the screen 10 years later.
Yeah,
I thought
that would make sense if you're going from 1972 to when Reagan is president. Reagan became president in 80, right? So you know by context clues that you're at least in 80, 81, 82, somewhere around there, right?
Yeah. But I don't know why I'm going to have to...
The question,
I won't do this any good for this episode, but I'll have to look it up later.
But that's
make an addendum or something.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's 10 years.
And not that it really matters exactly, but it's just I was just curious how long were they... But I believe I might have seen somewhere, it might have been mentioned in the first movie or the third movie, and God knows I don't remember, even though we just watched the third movie like last month, that they said somewhere along in their plot-wise that he was a POW for 7 years. So that will lead you to believe that this what you're seeing here might be late 70s. By the first movie, you're well into the 80s now, right? Some passage of time since he was a POW, now you know, he goes back to get more POWs in the first movie, remember? So, I don't know. Timeline-wise, yeah, this is where we need Austin around. Maybe he's got the...
Yeah, he probably does. He probably does.
There's the one scene where one of the guys, Opelka, he just takes off and runs away, and he actually manages to escape, or at least you know, you're led to believe it, because then right after that, they come back and say, oh, Opelka died, and then, ah, shit, Opelka's dead. And then eventually, oh, wait a minute, no, he's not. You know, he was just lying to Braddock, right?
Yeah.
So he actually got away briefly, and it was because of that opium hooker chopper that showed up. Because remember, like, he took off running, and then the chopper comes in, and you just kind of forget about him for a while?
Yeah.
So he was the one that got to take advantage of the, other than the guys at the camp there, they got to take advantage of the hooker chopper. and he just hid out in the jungle for the rest of the movie until he pops back up.
And that guy, the pilot, or I don't know if he was a pilot necessarily, but what if the guy that was like the main, the owner of the chopper, the guy that brought the hookers and all that stuff, he was French, right? I believe. I can't remember what his name was.
His name was Francois. How could you forget?
The most stereotypical French name.
Yeah, exactly.
I should have remembered that.
Exactly.
Francois. But yeah, that guy had some balls on him. Like, he's coming up to this guy who's got this, you know, the POW camp, who's obviously a, you know, Vietnamese communist soldier, dictator type or whatever.
Yeah.
The first time he gets off the plane, the guy, I forget what he said to him, but he's like, he basically belittles him in front of his men kind of thing, right?
Yeah. I think he thinks he's got the upper hand because he's the opium dealer that's clearly, like, financially supporting this whole outfit.
And then, like, he pulls him in there and is, although I don't know why he didn't do this in front of his men. Like, he gets humiliated in front of his men. You would think him being, you know, the way he is, that he would just berate the guy in front of the men so that he gets his respect back, right?
Yeah.
He's like, come into my office here. Let me talk to you.
And then berate
him. Don't put him on any chunks or whatever.
Yeah.
Don't ever do that part about me again. Well, the men don't know that you're doing this. They just think they just saw you get bitched by, you know, turned into a bitch by this guy.
There was one moment that gave me pause, because they mentioned it a couple of times and never necessarily retracted in the myth of these three movies. Braddock is married, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
Because they mentioned it a couple of times. They're like, your wife has let us know she's leaving you for another man or whatever that, you know, they're fucking with him, right? So clearly he is married, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go back to, what was it, Missing in Action 3, when he... All of a sudden, he had a Vietnamese wife and a child. So wait a minute. He was married. He was married in the States this whole time, and then fast forward, how many ever, you know, 10, 15, well, 15 something, whatever amount of years later, he had a wife and a kid that he was unaware of. Well, he was aware of the wife, of course. He was unaware of the kid. There was, in that movie, there was no mention of him previously being, I'm not that it matters that much, right? But when it kept saying it, I'm like, wait a minute. So that means he was married going into Vietnam, and then somewhere at the end of, so maybe the Colonel Yen wasn't fucking with him. Maybe she really was going to leave his ass. And that's what happened when he burned the letter up. Like, she actually did, write him a Dear John letter. Yeah. And then, like, well, he, after the war, he had, you know, once he got out, he had to move on. And
in that case, then I guess that Yen did him a favor for a little bit.
I guess so, because
he should have saved the letter. That would have been more torture than him burning it up, probably.
Because he ended up getting a hot Vietnamese wife who he was unaware. Timeline's a little sketchy, no doubt.
Yes, Lord.
I don't think we're supposed. I think in the end we're not supposed to pay that much attention to it, right? That's the point.
Obviously, the writers didn't.
Exactly.
There was a Missing Action 1 and 2, I guess.
It was the same three dudes for all three movies, which is the kicker. Like, you think they would have tied the shit together a little better. Steve Bing, Larry Levinson, and Arthur Silver should have done a better job of tying these loose threads up. You mentioned it briefly earlier, but the Nestor Braddock fight, you do get a pretty good long little fist fight here for, you know, that's about the only action you get in about the first 45 minutes or so, right?
Yeah, other than the torture.
That's
not really action. Just like them, you know, and the characters making you feel emotion for this, you know, as well as Braddock feeling emotion or whatever. But yeah, that's the only knockdown, drag out fight scene.
And then you get the final straw that breaks Braddock's back and makes him finally like, all right, we're getting the fuck out of here, is what happens to Franklin, one of the other soldiers. He gets malaria And then like Braddock finally breaks down, like, look, I'll tell you whatever you need to, you know, I'll get me on tape or whatever, confessing to these crimes so you can help Franklin out. He's dying of malaria. So instead of giving him the medicine for malaria, he pumps him full of a massive amount of opium, an overdose of opium, and then fucking just burns him alive, stretches him out as he's alive and he's high as a kite on opium, just pours gas all over him and burns him alive. So yeah, right after that, that's when you go full Chuck Norris, and that's the reason.
Yeah.
Probably one of the more fucked up scenes of the movie, honestly, if you think about it.
The burning scene? Yeah. Yeah. And it's actually, and it's the least, maybe the least amount of stuff shown, because I mean, he's opium, opium overdose. He's just like drugged and he's just being drugged along and whatever and all this stuff. But then in the burning scene, you don't see it on screen, really. You see him lighting something off screen. I mean, it's obviously him, you know, he's lighting the guy.
Then you hear him scream.
But yeah, for not being that as much shown. I mean, you still got burned up with a flamethrower earlier, and that's pretty fucked up, you know, everything. But it still didn't have the emotional impact that this scene had, because this is supposed to be the scene that breaks Braddock down then. He's like, okay, I'm done with this.
Yeah, you get two pretty good uses of flamethrowers in this movie. I'll give them that. Like, you get the dude's trying to escape, and then you get the, ha, flamethrower, you know, surprise flamethrower death. And then you get, you know, when Braddock is finally going, you know, getting his revenge on everybody, he flamethrows the two guys and then the bridge. Now, at first I'm like, why the fuck would he burn the bridge? Like, you got to get out of here. But then I guess it was to keep them there kind of thing, right? Like, so nobody's getting out of here, at least not easily. I think he does that to take the bad guys, right? He takes their ability to get out of there because he knows that that British guy that had shown up had hid some ropes or something underneath a rock or whatever, right? So he knows there's still a way to get across the river. They don't. So he takes out the bridge, I guess is the point.
Oh, yeah. We didn't mention that. I don't think we mentioned it before about the Francois, the helicopter guy that brings the hookers in, that he also brought in a cache of weapons on that helicopter.
Yeah.
And Chuck Norris notices that, or Braddock notices that and says, you know, see those boxes? That's full of, you know, weapons or whatever. So then they have that plan too. Now he's got a plan. Now he's like, they didn't know where his stash might be. Now they know that they got a shit ton of weapons. If they can get to them, they could probably, you know, escape.
Yeah. And really, they take like the next, what, probably 20 or 30 minutes of the movie. It kind of slows back down a little bit there of him just picking some guys off one by one and then going and stealing those weapons, right? To kind of set up the final battle here. And he blows up half that base. Like, he goes around, I guess, with some C4, whatever the hell he's got, out of that weapons cache, and then just blows half the, like, one by one, bam, bam, you know, and that's where, like, kind of the war is on, right?
Yeah.
How about when, okay, so he gets Mazzilli, and they go down to the river, and he's like, all right, we're going to get these ropes, and you're going to climb on down. I'm going to take out Yin. You know, like, Braddock's still got the revenge on his mind. You go ahead and go. I'm going to blow up. I'm going to go kill Yin, right?
Yeah.
Mazzilli gets down the cliff, but then there's another guy who grabs hold of the rope and starts going down. And then Braddock shoots the rope and snaps it, and the guy flies off the cliff and falls to his death. And you see it go all the way, right? Sort of those satisfying falls. But did you notice the dummy loses its head?
No. I was telling John that I didn't even see that part because, okay, this is. Yeah, we thought it was like, oh, damn, that looked pretty realistic. I didn't notice that part, but I made a joke. Have you seen Dr. Butcher MD, by the way?
Oh, yeah, that fall.
You remember that dummy fall in that one?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Boy, that's going to be an episode of the show at some point. I love that movie.
Sure, yeah.
But that's that. But there's a dummy seer there, and I commented to Tiana, like, at least when the dummy hit, his arm didn't fly off like it did Dr. Butcher MD. I did not notice his head fall.
remember the cheap ass fall and Never Too Young to Die? It was insane. Clearly,
dummy falls don't work out the way they expect.
Yeah, well, this one was the same. Go back and check it out. I don't remember exactly the timestamp of the movie, but go back and find it. You're roughly about an hour into the movie or so, maybe a little over at this point. Dude falls off the cliff. Right before the dummy hits the ground, you can see the head fly off, and then the dummy that hits the ground is a headless dummy. So I guess you're led to believe that, you know, the fall is at such a height that it just yanked his head right off of his body as before he hit the ground. The sheer force of gravity just yanked his head right off. But I saw it the first time. I'm like, wait a minute. So I rewound it and watched it like three times in a row. So it's worth checking out. It's worth One of these days, we need to have a Cliff Fall reel that we put on our YouTube channel. And this is going on the reel, trust me.
I think there was one in Strike Commando as well.
I mean,
it's Cliff Fall. It might not have been a dummy. I don't know how they did. I don't remember now, but I do remember there being a waterfall, Cliff Fall or something.
Yeah, a lot of them too. Like, you know, we've seen some pretty good ones, you know, throughout the 5+ years of the show. Usually they cut away. And I think that's usually the fatal flaw with these funny ones, that is that they show it to the end and they shouldn't. I get that they're trying to show you the impact. Oh man, that's fucked up. But like, that's how you poke holes in it, is you know, you saw the end of it. You, like, cause wasn't there another one in, X-ray Hospital Massacre, where the dude falls off the building and it's on fire, but they they keep showing it though, and it's like, okay, now you can. They showed it way too long, and now you can just clearly tell it's a fucking mannequin. It's the same thing. You talked about Francois. How about him bringing a knife to a gunfight when he finally met his end? Like, he realizes he's cornered, and then he just pulls out a knife, and then he just pow 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 pow. You know, they just mow him down. So yeah. Don't ever bring a knife to a gunfight.
That guy had some balls, all the stuff he said, but it did pay off for him.
As predicted, Francois bit it.
Yeah.
Out in the jungle, he finds Opelka. Remember the guy that, you know, he escaped, although they told him that he was dead. Well, he was out there hiding in the jungle, so he finds him. But meanwhile, they find, remember Mazzilli, who had climbed down the cliff, they find him, recapture him, and they've got him hostage. And Nestor, who was the traitor of the group, actually ends up dying trying to help Mazzilli and Braddock and everything. So in the end, for the entire run of the movie up to that point, he's a traitor and a turncoat and clearly just one of those self-preservation types. And then in the end, he has that moment of clarity, like, oh, man. And then, he died. Then you get, really, that's at that point, you get the final fight. And it's, once again, it's a long fight between Braddock and Colonel Yin. It's like a 10-minute fist fight. And that was what I was alluding to earlier. It's kind of like, that was pretty good, but I was kind of disappointed, like, you know, that Braddock didn't kill him, right? You know, that's my thought as I'm sitting there watching it. I'm like, yeah, it was pretty good, you know, it was satisfying. He won the fight, but Yin's still breathing. Well, that's kind of weak. And then he's like, what is he saying? This is for Franklin or whatever, right? When he kicked the shit out of him. And then the final line is, but this is for me. and then hits the button, you know, to blow. I'm blanking on what. Yeah, the detonator. Hits the detonator, and then boom. That's what I'm like, yeah, there we go. That's the cannon I know and love.
I mean, because I was telling Dan when we were watching this, the first time you might see that, or somebody would see this in the theater, and I'm like, think, damn, look at that. Chuck Norris has let this guy live?
It's been, I've seen this movie a number of times, but it's been so long, I'd kind of forgot how it ended. And I was like, you know, damn, that, you know, I kind of, you know, it's anticlimactic a little bit. You know, you figured he would have took this guy out, and then this is for me. Bam! You know, there we go. So, Yin blows up, and that's pretty much the end. Like, you get the credits. So, there you go.
Yep.
Missing in Action 2, the beginning. So, we watched them out of order, I think, the way that God and Golan and Globus intended. But we still get to the same point. So, Tana, we'll let ladies go first, since I know the Missing in Action movies are one of your favorite franchises. What's your thoughts and your final thoughts and your star rating on it?
I mean, I like Chuck Norris films, but this one's one of the weaker ones, I feel like.
Now, so, just as a reference, on our last Cannon Fodder, you gave Braddock Missing in Action 3 two stars, if that's going to affect, you know, where you sit this one at.
I give this one 2 also.
Well, that means at least you enjoyed it just as much as the last one. So we can work with that, right, Smoke?
Yeah. Hi.
Yeah. That's it. At least that's not, I'm going to completely shit on it. It's like, it is what it is, and two is fair. Okay, so Smoke, for you, just in the interest of fairness, I'll tell you what you rated all the way back in episode 122. So this, was, of course, before Tiana came on the show. You gave Missing in Action 5 cannonballs, and I should have mentioned, Tiana, too, this is the cannon scale, so to speak, cannonballs instead of stars. So, Smoke, you gave it 5 cannonballs, Missing in Action, and then Missing in Action 3, you gave 4 cannonballs. So that's where we're at with 1 and 3. So what do you think of 2?
I mean, I don't like it as much as I like the first one, but it is, I don't know. I like it a little bit better. Maybe, oh, maybe not. Maybe it's about equal to, but I think I do like it a little bit better than part 3. So my scale might be a little off there, because I would give this one a 4. Four Cannonballs. I enjoyed it. It's Chuck Norris. And I enjoyed it. It's not, it's not his best. My favorite personally from that we've done on the show, I'll say, because there's some that we haven't done yet. So we'll see what, when we get to those. My personal favorite of the ones we've done for canon on Chuck Norris's Invasion USA. But I'll go with four. I probably should maybe at some point, if I don't know if we're ever going to re-rate canon.
Yeah, we do.
When I might.
Cannon Fodder, yeah. It's up for debate when we have the sixth. This year will be the sixth anniversary show on Halloween. So, yeah.
At least it might. See, I might, because I do kind of like this a little bit better, even if it's maybe, some people might argue the fact that it's not any better than the third one. I mean, that's, you know, it's like splitting hairs there or whatever, but I do kind of like those a little bit better. Maybe it's just because of the story and time frame and everything of it. But yeah, for now, I'll go with four Cannonballs.
Well, Donnie wasn't able to be here, like I said, but he did drop us a rating, and he gives this four Cannonballs. And I think he thinks the same way you and I do, Smoke, with this movie. So I'm going to go with the same. I'm going to give it four Cannonballs. I'd say I probably like this one roughly about the same as the third one, maybe a little more, probably about like you, you know, like thinking back on it now, maybe I like this one a little more than three, but splitting hairs, you know, really.
Yeah, you know, it is. It also, it could be the fact that I've seen this one a lot more times than I've seen part three. Maybe I need to see part three another time before I, you know, before it comes time for us to re-rate them.
Yeah,
look, we're fair to say. I've just seen this one a lot, so there's that nostalgia factor more so with this one. I only saw part three one time back in the day when it came out or so, and the time that we did it again for the podcast.
Plus, I've said this a few times. I always have to, when we're talking about canon movies, factor in my ratings. For as many missing in actions, there's probably double the amount of frog princes and pirates and shit like that. There's some really crappy canon movies that we've yet to do, you know, and we've done a few, but there's a lot coming.
Oh yeah,
you know, so
yeah,
I have to factor that into my decisions too. Like, you know what, like, this may not have been perfect, but man, it is so much better than some of that other shit. So I give myself some wiggle room there on the scale. So
I've learned that too. I have to do that since the beginning of the show, that because we did do the Frog Prince, right? That's what we've got.
Yes. Unfortunately, yes.
And yeah, I'm sure there's much more terrible. Is that if you were to put, you know, Missing in Action 2 is no masterpiece, that's for sure. But it will be, like, seen like a masterpiece when we get down to some of the dregs of canon, you know, canon fodder.
Exactly. We set at 3.5 Cannonballs. So I think overall we more than recommend, you know, even with Tiana's two Cannonballs bringing it down a little bit, we more than recommend you go check it out. If you're a Chuck Norris fan, you'll love it. And honestly, if you're a Chuck Norris fan, you've probably seen it a number of times at this point anyways. But if you haven't, go check it out. And honestly, go check out all three of the Missing in Action movies. Now that we can look back at the whole thing, I mean, overall, we gave the first one 4.8 Cannonballs. We gave the second one now 3.5 Cannonballs. And we gave the third one consensus 3.75 Cannonballs. So obviously, all three of the Missing in Action flicks we highly recommend from Canon Film. So that'll put a pin in it. I mean, because it's Canon fodder, we don't do a lot of the usual stuff like the gore score and all highlight kills and all that. So we'll leave it there. So, although I'll have to say, if I was doing a highlight kill, it would probably be Yen blowing up, because that's the most satisfying at the end.
Right? Yeah, like, finally.
Yeah. kick his ass. But yeah, that's where we'll leave it. So next week, we return back to the rotation, and we're going to be talking about a movie that you picked, Smoke. So what are we going to be talking about next week?
Next week is going to be one I haven't seen. I picked it because I've been wanting to see it, but I finally did get to see it. So it's Summer of 84, which was for anybody who hasn't seen it, it's a sort of one a neo-80s, you know, yes, a throwback to the 80s that was made, I forget what year was it. I don't even remember what year was it.
2018, I believe it was.
It came out in 2018, but it's set in 1984, obviously, Summer of 84. And it's a good little throwback horror movie that we'll get into on the next episode. Well, yeah.
It's first time watch for me, too. So, I'm going to assume it's probably going to be the same for a couple of us. So we'll get into that next week. So onward and upward, we got a lot of stuff coming ahead of us after that. And, you know, before you know it, man, I mean, I know we're in the middle of March here, but before you know it, we'll be releasing our summer event plans. You know, every year, if you've been a listener of the Spook Show, you know, every summer we have a big event. So sooner rather than later, probably within the next month, we'll be able to announce exactly what that's going to be. So keep your eyes and ears open for that. So for Will and Donnie, Tiana, Professor Smoke, I'm Josh. We are the All-American Spook Show, and we'll talk to you next week.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.